This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, it's a good time right now to give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And along with our listener calls, Zorba, some research to talk over.
Yes, we're going to talk about kissing. You know, humans kiss. And,
yeah, right.
90% of all societies kiss. We're going to talk about the hormones involved in kissing and what it means to you.
There's been some research.
What it means to you. Yes, we're discussing the science of philematology, the science of kissing.
Okay.
And I will spell philematology when we actually get to the discussion.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about drinking. Is it bad for you? Does it cause cancer? Does it decrease cancer? What's the relationship to heart disease and stroke? We're talking about moderate drinking, 1 to 2 glasses of beer or wine or hard spirits, and we'll give you the latest data.
Okay, those coming up. What's our recipe?
We've got a recipe from the vault. It's Roquefort chicken. We've had lots of requests for this for years. I happen to love Roquefort blue cheese. Fancy name, but really a special kind of cheese for blue cheese. It's a dynamite recipe. You will want this recipe. I guarantee it.
800-462-7413. Again, our toll-free number. Zorba, a listener with us now in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet. Thanks for calling. How can we help?
Well, when I run on the treadmill, after about a mile or so, my feet begin to fall asleep, and I have to get off and walk around and do a little bit of stretching, and I notice that my calves are swollen up, and it kind of bothers me, so I was wondering if you could help me with that.
Yeah. Now, has this been going on ever since you started using the treadmill?
No, it just happened recently, and I've switched from sprinting and then walking to a more sustained long-distance running, so I'm wondering if that has something to do with it.
Uh-huh. When you get off, when you have the numbness and get it fixed and you get back on, is it okay then?
Well, I can run for longer, but... say if I ran 1 mile and I had to stop, then maybe I could run 2 miles and then I had to stop again.
I got it. I've got a couple of questions. Now, this bothers you on the treadmill. Does it bother you when you're jogging outside, too, or just when you're on the treadmill?
I haven't been jogging outside here lately because the weather's been bad.
Okay, so you've noticed it on the treadmill. You've been an inside person, so you move around, you get off there, like you say, you sort of shake things out. How long does that take before the sensation goes away? Is it like 30 seconds or 5 minutes or 10 minutes? How long does it take?
I'd say between 5 and 10 minutes.
Okay, that's quite a long time. You're not a smoker, right? I assume that because you're a jogger, right? Or am I wrong?
No, I'm not.
Okay, because that's important. One of the things that can happen with smoking is smoking can affect the peripheral circulation and cause problems, and people often will have numbness and tingling and a whole bunch of other things that occur from smoking, so we can put that off to the side. Now, when you run on the treadmill, do you have it geared up? Are you on a grade of 5, 10, or 15%, you know, where you push the button and the grade goes up, or are you flat on the ground?
Flat on the ground.
Flat on the ground. Shoes, new, old, different? Change your shoes at all?
Tried 2 or 3 different pairs.
Okay.
Doesn't really seem to help.
Okay, good. That, by the way, is important because sometimes it's the tightness of the shoe that can cause the paresthesia. That's what you have, this numbness and kind of tingling stuff. The tightness of the shoe can do it. The treadmill, are you bouncing on the treadmill or is it solid?
I would say bouncing. I've been doing a lot of heavy squats here lately, and it kind of messed... messes up my joints, and I sometimes wonder if I've forgotten how to run. So. Uh-huh.
Well, I think we've got some of the issues are stretching before you get. I've got a couple of very specific suggestions. First of all, I think this is from pressure on your peripheral nerves when you're pounding the treadmill. That's what I think. And the reason why I asked about jogging outside, which is what I want you to do when you can do it, is sometimes irregular ground will be better for you and not cause the problems, and jogging on cement or blacktop will cause the problems. Jogging on a jogging track would be ideal because it's not irregular and has a lot of bounce to it. This is not an uncommon problem at all. So one of the things you want to do is look at the socks. Make sure your socks are puffy enough and spongy enough. The heels of your shoe are spongy enough to make a difference. The last on the shoe that you tighten up is not too tight, but I think your key is stretching exercises before you get on there. I think there's something going on. I don't think this is circulatory at all. I think it's the stretching exercises, the muscles and the ligaments that you've got to attack on there. And then if you find that when you're on the treadmill, when you're sprinting and running on the treadmill, you get it every time, then what your answer is fast walking. Because you have this repetitive motion, this repetitive pounding, and fast walking may allow you to reach the ideal heart rate that you want to get to and not produce this. So those are my suggestions. And good luck. This is sometimes a hard problem to solve.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Zorba.
Pleasure. Thanks for listening, too.
And we appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. Before we take our next call, Zorba, let's talk about this kissing study.
Yes. I think this is very important. Did you know that this is the study of philematology, philematology?
Until today, I did not know.
Yeah,
that.
I must admit, I never learned the word philematology in medical school. It was not what was on there. But actually, what they're looking at is kissing is present in about 90% of all societies. In other words, it's a common human condition, and they were looking at hormones that are involved with kissing, male hormones, mm-hmm. female hormones.
Right.
I can see that I've gotten your attention with
sure.
this. Sometimes you're sort of half asleep when we discuss the latest research.
I'm never half asleep.
You're
always attentive, whatever the subject.
Well, with this topic, you are right on top. So these were heterosexual college students in a student health service. So they're doing the research, not in a romantic setting. You got it? It's a student health service listening to music and kissing for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, I'm making an assumption that these are not random students, but that was not in the data. You know, I mean,
it probably were couples.
Well, I don't really know if they were couples or not. They were coupling for this.
Yeah.
That much I can tell you. They definitely were coupling to this. But they looked at levels. There's a chemical oxytocin. Oxytocin turns out to be very important for women. It's the letdown reflex when they're actually breastfeeding, and it's involved in a variety of bonding issues. So oxytocin, they were looking at cortisol, which is a measure of stress. They were looking at blood levels and saliva levels. In other words, they were measuring their saliva before and afterwards, and mm-hmm. they were doing blood tests.
Yeah.
Lo and behold, there was a difference. Both men and women, though, were similar. They had a decline in cortisol levels when they were actually kissing.
That's the stress.
Correct. In other words, kissing relieves stress. Stressed out, find somebody to kiss.
Yeah. Good
simple.
Idea.
Yeah, it's very simple. You stress out, go home, kiss somebody. 15 minutes, you'll get rid of all your stress if it's somebody who you want to kiss with.
Yeah.
But anyway, But what was interesting is that in men, the oxytocin levels increased.
That's the bonding.
Mm-hmm, that implied that's what increases when people want to bond, which is one step away from copulation.
All right, yeah.
One step away from copulation bonding. Whereas the oxytocin levels went down in women.
So women were kissing and were less interested in
bonding.
During
which
the
is a proxy for copulation.
Less interested in bonding, and then became obviously more interesting.
Now there's some theories involved here that actually kissing is a prelude to copulation, and that men are more interested in copulation. Women are more interested in finding a mate that they can have, that they can actually copulate with and have a child, and they want to make sure that they can tolerate the mate until the child grows up. So there clearly are other issues with women in kissing and copulation and bonding than there are with men. So you know what the bottom line is?
Well, no.
Well, it's hard to tell the bottom line from the study. The bottom line is it relieves stress in both cases, but women are looking for more romance in order for them to have their letdown reflex, the copulation reflex.
And to women, bonding and romance are different things.
Are different issues.
Men, of course, it's
right.
all
the same. Yes, it's all the same. It's all the same. It's all the same. And let's remember, this took place in a student health service. It wasn't in a romantic environment.
Well, but with music going on.
There's music.
That's and I right. assume it was romantic
right.
music.
I assume it was romantic.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in Danville, Kentucky. Hi.
Hi there.
What's up?
Well, I'm calling because I found an enlarged lymph node in my neck 3 years ago, and I have been to three different doctors to have it checked out, all of whom have agreed that it's most likely a benign reactive lymph node, but I'm a big worrier, and I've continued to worry about it over the years, and my ENT on my second visit said that he would order a biopsy to ease my mind. He was clear that it's not his recommendation, but that he could tell I'm worried about it, so he would allow me to have it. My husband thinks that it's an unnecessary risk to have an invasive procedure when none of the doctors I've seen have actually recommended a biopsy. So I was just calling to get your thoughts and your opinion.
Well, I've got a couple opinions. First of all, this has gone on for 3 years. So
right.
the lymph node has been there for 3 years. That's a lot of information right there. A lymph node that is lymphoma, for instance, Hodgkin's lymphoma or cancer, they grow. They get bigger. They don't get smaller in size. They get larger in size. And after 3 years, if this were a lymphoma-type lymph node, I would have expected it would have gotten larger. In other words, you'd say, hey, it's a bean size. Now it's a lima bean size. Or now it's become a walnut size. You know, and they become larger. And those are the ones you really have to biopsy. So the chances of this being a reactive lymph node, certainly greater than 95%, might be 99%. Then it's a function of how comfortable you feel. So some people say, you know what? I want to have this thing biopsied. I want to be able to put it to rest. I can't stand it. I think about it every day. Those people should have either the full biopsy, take out the node, put it under the microscope, or something called a skinny needle biopsy where they freeze the skin and they put a needle in. It's no more invasive than putting a needle in your arm to get blood. It's really very non-invasive, done in the right hands. It's very, very safe. And that might give you a sense of comfort. But for a lot of people, they say, I don't need the comfort. I'm fine. Because you've watched it for 3 years. Chances are 99% it is a reactive lymph node.
But she's a little concerned about it. And you're saying there's no danger with the biopsy.
The danger is minimal. The danger is minimal. It's in the neck, but it's really it's a very tiny needle. It's a needle just like you would have blood taken. It's a very small needle. And if it's on the surface, the chances of a nerve injury, which is really the issue, are very small. Probably 1 in 5,000, 1 in 10,000. It's pretty small. The risk of something happening is probably the risk of you're getting into a car accident going to work today.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, what are your chances? Day is sunny. It's bright. It's not an ice storm. Let's say on a bright, sunny day, the risk of getting into a car crash are 1 in 10,000 probably. So the risk of anything happening here is probably in the same range. It's really minimal. But it's not zero. But it's
right.
minimal. If I were a worrier and I were worried about it, I would go and have it out and I'd say, take out the whole thing. I don't want to think about it. That's okay. That's a good enough reason to do it. And it's not as if you're having a bunch of other tests done. I mean, do you always have tests done on your body and worry about them?
No, this one is just particularly worrisome,
yes.
I guess, because of the you know, what it could be, you know. And if I were to not have it biopsied and to just leave it, or am I at any increased risk for any complications or cancer later? Or
no.
I mean, why is it reactive? Why is it enlarged?
Because you had an infection there and it just got enlarged and it's like a scar on your skin. You get 10 million cuts when you're a kid and one of them scars. Why did that one scar? I don't know. It just scarred. This is like a scarred lymph node. That's all it is. It's probably scar tissue. So good luck to you and good luck in your decision.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. 800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to Carbondale, Illinois now. Hi.
Well, hello, fellas. By the way, the advice on kissing is working.
Working for you?
Well, my wife and I were just engaged here for a second.
That's what I like to see. I like to see people take my advice right from the onset.
Well, we're glad you're still with us on the phone.
I'm a 59-year-old fellow, and I'm generally in very good health. I don't take any medications. I don't have any situations. But I'm lying in bed a few weeks ago, and my right foot begins to swell and throb, and it was excruciatingly painful. And the next morning, my wife hobbled me into the emergency clinic, and the doctor, really nice fellow, looks at it and says, "I think you have gout." I thought I'd been bitten by something. Well, he can't find a puncture mark. So he says, "Well, let's take a picture and get some blood. That'll tell us what's going on." And the picture comes back, and he says, "Oh, there's a bone chip on the joint by your big toe." And he said, "Well, let's see what the blood does." And so I go home, and I ice my foot and elevate it and pop a Vicodin and turn on a spaghetti Western. And if the Vicodin doesn't knock you out, the spaghetti of Western will. Works every time. So then he calls back and he says, "Well, the uric acid in your blood is normal." So they think now it is the bone chip that's doing this. So I was wondering, my first question is, I've always associated people with gout that don't exercise, don't eat the right kinds of food, maybe have hypertension, those kinds of problems. Am I on board with this or not?
No, actually, I've got some good information. The uric acid can be normal during an acute flare.
Oh.
So when you have an acute flare, the uric acid may be normal, and so you can't trust it. If it's elevated, it's good information, and you can make a presumptive diagnosis from gout. If it's normal, you've got to take it 2 to 4 weeks later. So normal uric acid does not rule out gout.
Okay.
The only way to definitively actually rule in or rule out gout is actually to stick a needle in the joint and look for crystals. That's the only definitive way. 90%, 99% of the people who are diagnosed with gout do not have that done. But you can make a presumptive diagnosis clinically. If you've got a red hot swollen toe, it starts suddenly, it happens within 24 hours. This sounds like gout. Does not sound like that, like there's a chip at all. I mean, a chip can be a little painful, but you don't get a red hot toe like you're describing. Happen in the joint, the first joint of the toe, of the great toe?
Yeah,
that's smells to me like that's gout. So you need to repeat uric acid, but I want to give you some data. Gout is a metabolic disease. It is not related to bad living. Now,
okay,
you can get flares from bad living, but it was thought to be related to bad living, but it isn't. And there's a drug, allopurinol, which has been on the market for 30 years. So we don't see much gout because that drug works 90% of the time. It reduces uric acid 90% of the time, and people are on it for a lifetime if they get recurrent gout flares. First flare, some people start to take it, but if they have two or three flares, they go, "I don't want to have this anymore." Now, what will make gout worse will be cold weather. Drinking alcohol can do it, a couple of beers. Beers are especially that. High dose of aspirin. Certain foods will bring it on if you eat them to excess, like liver.
A lot of
people don't eat liver anymore. Having lobster every day and lots of seafood, those are things to do. But for the most part, and trauma will do it too. Gout just happens. Allopurinol is the drug of choice. There's a new drug that's coming on the market called Euloric, which will also work, but that'll be more expensive. Allopurinol is where I would go first. But this is only one attack. So you have to decide if you want to take a pill for the rest of your life to keep the attacks from happening. Usually, people will say, "Hey, I've had one attack. I'm going to wait for the second or third attack before I do it." And other people say, "No, I don't want to get it again." Treatment is anti-inflammatories. Very good drug is Aleve. Aleve is great.
Yeah, well, Aleve does weird things to my kidneys, I think.
Oh, okay. So what did you take for this, for the acute attack?
Well, they gave me a steroid shot.
Steroids are also a good way to do it.
Took the swelling down in a few hours.
Yeah, this is gout. A bone chip, the swelling would not come down. It's gout. You got gout.
Okay.
Now, I haven't seen you, but smells like gout, sounds like gout. I think you've got gout.
All right.
So,
okay.
Good luck. Now remember, one of the ways that you reduce the stress from a painful toe and gout is to kiss.
Okay, well, I'll go work on it right now.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks, fellas.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's check in on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox now, Zorba, and see if we can help out Jim from Lafayette, Indiana, who has a problem with what he calls trigger finger. He writes, "My little finger on my left hand sometimes snaps when I move my fingers. I had the same problem with the middle finger on that hand and had an operation with a hand clinic. It was successful. I would just as soon prefer not to have another operation if there is some other way to mitigate the situation, perhaps some exercise.
Well, actually, a trigger finger is treated for most people with an injection of a steroid into the palm of the hand, where the problem is. It's actually not in the finger. Trigger fingers, your finger gets kind of stuck as you're opening up. Mm-hmm. I have it. I've had trigger finger on and off for the last 5 years. Every year or two, I go and I get an injection from my local doc who gives me an injection. It goes right into the base of the finger, into the middle of the palm, which is where it occurs. It's a swelling where we sort of have pulleys and ligaments, and they move over, and it's very effective. And the last injection lasted for 2.5 years, and I got an injection 2 weeks ago, and my trigger finger's gone.
Oh.
So you don't need surgery. You need an injection. That's my recommendation.
Hmm. Give your fingers some exercise by sending us your questions, comments, and tips in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up. It's a recipe from the vault. More of your calls, of course. Our medical myth buster as well. And some interesting research here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Glad to have you along. That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But right now it's recipe time again, Zorba. We have a segment on this show where we dust off an old recipe from our vault to share once again with our listeners. And today's recipe is a special request from Jack in Wisconsin. Now, Jack writes, several years ago, you gave us a recipe for a Roquefort or blue cheese chicken that was so very, very good. I've searched your website for the recipe but cannot find it. Would you please tell me where to find it? We can find it right here, Jack. Once again, the recipe for Roquefort chicken.
Now, I happen to love the name Roquefort chicken, and because Roquefort reminds me of my mother-in-law, who I really, really liked, because we used to go to this wonderful, wonderful barbecue and steak place in Chicago called Miller's, and you had to pay $1 extra if you ordered Roquefort with your salad.
Yeah.
And Roquefort is really a very, very tasty type of blue cheese. You can use any blue cheese that you want to in this, but Roquefort is a more expensive, creamier, delicious, more aged blue cheese. I happen to love blue cheese crumbles. Any way you make blue cheese, I happen to like it. Mm-hmm. But if you use Roquefort cheese, a more expensive cheese, this does taste better. And it may remind you of your mother-in-law, too. And hopefully you have good times with your mother-in-law. But anyway, Roquefort chicken, it's a great recipe. We're going to talk about things. You'll love this. So
Okay. Start
out with 1/4 cup of white flour. And I used enriched white flour for this.
What's the difference?
Nothing. Nothing at all. But you know what the enriched – it means it has vitamins in it. That's all. It's enriched with vitamins. So regular – when you buy all-purpose white flour, it's enriched in America. Oh. And most bread flour also has vitamins in it. And frankly, that's how we got rid of vitamin deficiency. But it doesn't matter. Any kind of white flour.
A quarter cup of white flour.
You could vary this if you want to, and you could use cornmeal instead of white flour, which will make it a little bit crunchier. Mm-hmm. And you could use whole wheat flour to add a little fiber.
Okay.
1 teaspoon of salt.
Little tea, salt.
Kosher salt is better. It'll actually taste better with kosher salt. A teaspoon of dried rosemary crumbled.
Little tea, crumbled dried rosemary.
And you know, Tom, when you make any recipe and you use rosemary, you know how they're really stiff things. So you've got to crumble. You've got to crumble the dried rosemary because I'm sure you do that all the time.
Whatever.
When you're in the kitchen. I would I would venture to guess that if I gave you rosemary to look at or to smell, you wouldn't really know. And I gave you three or four spices. You wouldn't know which one was rosemary.
No, I wouldn't
right?
have a clue.
No, you wouldn't have a clue. Yeah. But for those of us who have a clue, a dried rosemary crumbled, 1 teaspoon.
Yeah.
Half a teaspoon of dry thyme crumbled.
Half a little tea dried thyme crumbled.
Six skinless, boneless chicken breast halves. Yeah, to, you know, decide the size of the chicken breast that you want to use. 3 tablespoons of canola margarine. You could use any margarine you want to, and you could use olive oil if you want to, but 3 tablespoons of soft canola margarine.
3 big tea soft canola margarine.
2/3 of a cup of non-fat plain yogurt. Make sure it's not sweetened. Make sure it's not vanilla. It's non-fat plain yogurt.
Right. 2/3 of a cup of non-fat plain yogurt.
That's exactly right. And you're going to use 1/3 of a cup of Roquefort cheese. And yes, you can use any blue cheese that you want to, but Roquefort will taste better.
1/3 of a cup of Roquefort cheese crumbled.
2 tablespoons of fresh lemon juice. Get it. If you're going to make this recipe, get a lemon and juice the lemon. Mm-hmm. It tastes better.
2 big tea of lemon juice.
Yeah. If not, use the frozen reconstituted. It's much better than the stuff on the shelf, but fresh is much better here. Mm-hmm. 1 tablespoon of green onion thinly sliced.
1 big tea of green onion thinly sliced.
1/2 teaspoon of zested orange peel. That's nice grated zested orange peel.
1/2 tea, a grated orange peel.
And some paprika.
Paprika.
Now, there's an important thing about paprika. When you open up paprika, it's good for about a year. After a year, it starts to lose its flavor and has a little bit of a bitter taste. And a lot of people have paprika on their shelf for a decade because they don't use much of it, right. So it's sort of sitting there. So buy a small container of paprika. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. And after a year, put a little date on the bottle. And when you notice it's been there for a year or so, toss it. So, preheat the oven to 350 degrees. And by the way, if you don't have an oven thermometer, buy one. And the reason is most ovens are off by 30 degrees, either 30 degrees or 40 degrees, up or down. So, get an oven thermometer and pay attention to what's in the mm-hmm. oven. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees. Then, in a shallow pan, combine the salt, the flour or cornmeal, if you're going to use that, rosemary, thyme, and pepper. Dredge the chicken breast in the flour and spice mixture. If it doesn't stick, by the way, what you can do is dip the chicken breast in milk first and then dredge it. That'll get it to stick a little bit better. Then in a large heavyweight skillet, melt the canola margarine or olive oil over medium heat. Brown the chicken breast in batches, turning each time until they're golden brown, about 5 to 7 minutes. Then place the chicken breast in a large baking dish. Don't overlap it nice and flat. Then in a small bowl, combine the yogurt with all the remaining ingredients and spread the yogurt mixture over the chicken. Sprinkle lightly with, once again, good paprika. Bake for 30 minutes until the topping is golden brown and the chicken is baked through to 185 degrees on an instant read thermometer, and you've got a dish that you can be proud of.
Yeah, this sounds delicious. I don't remember doing this recipe in the past. I'm sure, I know we did because...
Well, it's from the vault. It's from the vault. And that, of course, is the first sign of Alzheimer's disease.
As many recipes as we've done, I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Anyway.
350 calories in this recipe, 9 grams of fat, not bad. It obviously all comes from the Roquefort. Yeah. This is really, I mean, it's 1/3 of a cup spread out over over 6 boneless chicken breasts. It's delicious.
Yeah, Jack, thanks a lot for suggesting that we dig this one out of the vault. Again, it sounds delicious. And again, if there's a recipe you remember but can't find, or there's one you feel deserves an encore performance, let us know what it is, and it might end up being our next recipe from the vault. Just send the name of the recipe and an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you'd like a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly podcast, our recipe podcast, and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
is our toll-free number. That's 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, let's welcome a listener now in Guthrie, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Well, there's a problem my son and I both have had. I was diagnosed at 19 with a bleeding ulcer. I'd had symptoms my whole life, and it just seems I have a very high level of acid in my system. I've had acid reflux most of my life. Not only is it my digestive system, but I can't wear a watch that isn't stainless steel or my skin literally eats the metal away.
Oh.
Yeah, and my son, who is 5 now, was diagnosed at 3.5 weeks, but he's had acid reflux his whole life, and both of us are on medicine, and, you know, the only option we have at this point is just keep upping the dose and upping the dose, and I'm trying to find out if there's another way I can lessen or, you know, obviously not eliminate the acidity in my system and his, because it's just, it makes life very complicated.
Oh, I bet it does. It sounds like you're really suffering.
Yes, it's both of us.
Yeah, it really sounds awful. Let's talk about you first. So what are you on? What are you taking?
I take prescription Prilosec. I believe I'm on 150 milligrams.
So how many capsules are you taking? They come in 20s.
These are just little round pills.
Mm-hmm. Or pills.
they're the prescriptions, so they're not the little capsules. I was taking them twice a day, but then I'm now 5 months pregnant, and at the beginning of my pregnancy, I don't know if it just changed my system.
Oh,
but
it does. It does.
I was doubled over in pain for weeks, and finally the doctor put me on 4 times a day.
So you're taking Prilosec in the morning. Anything at night when you go to sleep?
Well, he put me on Prilosec like 4 times a day with the pregnancy.
A couple of suggestions just for you. What you may want to do is take Zantac, over-the-counter Zantac, 300 milligrams at bedtime. It works differently, and some people are helped by taking Prilosec or Nexium or one of the drugs in the class. There are 5 approved by the FDA in that class. You take one in the morning. You take another one in the evening. They're all a little different. They're not exactly the same. So if Prilosec doesn't work, I try Nexium or Asifex or Protonix. As I said, there's several other drugs in the class, and I would try another one. But take some Zantac at bedtime. And then during the day, Tums and Rolaids, avoid all alcohol. Obviously, you're doing that because you're pregnant. And no caffeine. Are you drinking any caffeine?
Very rarely.
Get
I get migraines, so sometimes Mountain Dew is better than the heavy-duty pills I should be taking
actually,
when I'm pregnant.
And actually, for a migraine, that's a good idea. But if not, do that. And that's what I would do. Zantac at bedtime. Go to a different proton pump inhibitor, a different drug than the Prilosec. Now, your son, you said, is on it? Is on what is your son on? Is your son on Zantac or what?
He's on Zantac.
Okay, so...
The best one we ever used for him was, I think it was the Prevacid, but then our insurance quit covering it as a powder for a kid, and they aren't covering it anymore.
Right, but that's going to come off patent in about a year, by the way, just to let you know. If that's a better drug, the price is going to drop within a year. This can be a chronic problem, but 90% of the people, once we find the right amount, get better, and you just may need to be on a high dose forever. I mean, basically, these drugs, the person who developed the drug, basically Zantac, got the Nobel Prize and was cited for medicine as helping more people reduce pain in their lives than anybody else in the last 100 years. Because these drugs, when they work, are dynamite. Morphine didn't work for this. Heroin didn't work for this. People took everything. These drugs and the drugs in this class are dynamite. What you've got to do is work with your doctor and find the right combination that works for you. So try that out and give us a call back and let us know.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure. Thank you. We appreciate the call. We check in now on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and see if we can help out Nate from Waupaca, Wisconsin. Now, Zorba, Nate gets headaches anytime he drinks regular Pepsi, even though he can handle what our last caller mentioned, Mountain Dew and Diet Coke, just fine. So headaches from Pepsi, no headaches from Mountain Dew and Diet Coke. Nate continues, on a friend's suggestion, I marinated a steak in Pepsi and Worcestershire sauce last night. I let it sit for about an hour in the fridge before grilling. After dinner, I got up from the table to play with the kids before bed, the same headache again. And no, it wasn't from the kids. So what's going on here?
Stay away from Pepsi. You know, these things have different ingredients. I have no idea what's going on. You've got clearly have a food intolerance. Pepsi is a food. I mean, that's what it is. It's a junk food, but it's a food. I mean, well, it's got calories in it, so it's a food. It's not neutral. And there are a variety of secret ingredients. You know, nobody knows the way Pepsi is made. Nobody knows the way Coke is made exactly. And there obviously must be some flavoring in there that you are allergic to or hypersensitive to. My recommendation is Coca-Cola products. That's it.
Well, isn't Mountain Dew a Pepsi product?
Oh, you know, but it's a different combination.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And it's clearly not the caffeine, because Mountain Dew has more caffeine than Pepsi. So I don't know. You don't need Pepsi to survive. It's not as if Pepsi is one of the four basic food groups. Give it up. And besides, how did that marinated steak taste marinated in Pepsi?
Must have been delicious.
I mean, how motivated are you to drink this stuff? Good luck.
If a lifestyle or health problem is giving you a headache, we want to help. Send us your questions in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some interesting research coming up. More of your phone calls. Oh, and our medical MythBuster, too. All here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, that toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. But before we get back to the phones, some research, Zorba, showing the benefits and or the disadvantages of moderate drinking.
Well, drinking is very interesting. Alcohol, the issues with alcohol have been around for a long time. And we know from a heart disease point of view that a glass of wine, red wine, is what the French would like us to think is important. But the data really shows that alcohol has some benefit from a cardiac point of view for both men and women.
We've talked about in the past.
Over and over. And the type of alcohol may not matter. Now, the issues now have to do with cancer. Mm-hmm. So one issue is that we know that alcoholics, people who drink large amounts of alcohol, are more likely to have a type of esophageal cancer called essentially squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus. Very serious cancer. It occurs much more commonly with lots of alcohol. But there's a type of esophageal change called Barrett's esophagitis. Thickening, a change in the esophagus. We see it with a lot of people with acid reflux, and some people, about 1% or 1.5% of those with Barrett's, go into esophageal cancer. And esophageal cancer is a type of cancer that's increasing in our society. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to look to see whether or not wine drinking decreased Barrett's and may decrease esophageal cancer. And lo and behold, people who had Barrett's esophagitis actually had a decrease when they drank wine. That wine reduced the amount of esophageal cancer that was present for this one type of esophageal cancer from that. So it may be protective.
Yeah, but now we have this other big study in Great Britain, which seems to show that moderate drinking increases risk.
It increases risk of breast cancer. And for moderate drinking, they define that, and this is in women in Great Britain, they define it as women who had two or more drinks a day versus women who had a drink a day or three or four or five drinks a week. And these were looking at women. So the real issue, I think, with alcohol, the bottom line with alcohol is this. A drink a day appears to be safe. It really does. It appears to be safe. It appears to be cardioprotective in men and women. It may reduce the risk of one type of esophageal cancer and not increase the risk of breast cancer. Once you get over one drink a day, then you start to have the side effects. And I think that's kind of the bottom line. The question is it one drink or two drinks? I think the data is very good that one drink is safe. And I think that's what we have to think about.
I tend not to think of two or more drinks a day as moderate drinking.
No, well, but that's how, yes. Well, it depends on where you are. You know, in the state of Wisconsin, I'll say to my patients, do you drink? And they say, I don't drink much. How much do you drink? I drink three or four drinks a day. Well, to me, that's a lot of alcohol. But one drink a day is okay, appears to be safe, and may protect you from cancer.
800-462-7413, toll free. And a caller now, Zorba, in Coleman, Michigan. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, this call is mostly about my wife. She has some health problems, and she's been directed to take some dietary supplements, especially, I guess one thing I'm concerned about is she takes some pills that include vitamin B12, which is fine. I mean, you need vitamins. But on the label, it says that, one of them, it says that it contains 83,000% of the recommended daily allowance of vitamin B12. And I've looked up, and I can't find that there's an upper limit of these recommendations. But I guess it just seems to me that too much of a good thing is never a good thing.
Yeah. Who directed her to take this B12?
She started going to a new doctor recently. And before that, she had been taking something similar on her own.
Mm-hmm. B12 is very interesting. It's only found in animal sources. It's not in vegetarian sources. So if you're a vegan, a very strict vegan, a strict vegetarian, and where are you going to get your vitamin B12 from? Well, it turns out that vegans often have vitamin B12, and they try to figure out where it came from. And it came from the insect parts that are present in vegetables. It's very, very kind of, I found it fascinating. We need a tiny amount of vitamin B12 to make our blood. And a vitamin B12 deficiency can be very serious. You can have neurological problems, but you don't need much at all. Now, the other thing about B12 is a lot of people have said, well, taking large amounts of B12 will help things. It'll help pain and discomfort and make you feel better and increase your sex drive. It's been touted for everything. We don't think there's an upper limit to B12, and most of the B12 tablets contain enormous amounts because you only need a trace of B12. So I'm not surprised that it says 83%. Now, some
83,000%, yeah.
Now, 83,000 of vitamin A or vitamin D would actually cause you problems, or vitamin K. So fat-soluble vitamins definitely have an upper limit, and when you broach that upper limit, you cause problems. Large amounts of pyridoxine phosphate also, which has been, some people have thought, is useful to prevent insect bites and help with dizziness. And large amounts seem to cause difficulty in people walking with their gait. So some of these vitamins definitely have side effects in large amounts. Niacin's a good example. As a vitamin, it only replaces things. In large amounts, it lowers cholesterol and causes flushing and palpitations. Mm. So it depends on the vitamin. B12 in large amounts is totally safe. But according to the data that I read, not only is it safe, but it's worthless. It's not doing anything. But people take it, they say they feel better, and I figure it doesn't cause any harm. So the placebo effect is always worth a lot.
Okay. All right.
So good luck. Now, you and your wife have had some discussions about this?
That would be putting it lightly, sure.
Good luck on that. So thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. 800-462-7413. Zorba, time again on the show for our medical myth buster now. We have a listener myth about microwaves today from Brittany in St. Louis, Missouri. Brittany writes, as a kid, I was always cautioned against standing in front of or near the microwave. Some said it would cook my insides. Others mentioned the onset of cancer. Even today, those words still come to mind, and I'm careful to walk away whenever my microwave is running. Is there any truth to these, in quotes, old wives' tales?
Zero. Zero, 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 zero. It's amazing how this myth has continued. You know, if you look at injuries in the kitchen, it starts with the knives and ends with the stove. I mean, you're much more likely to burn your hands and scald yourself with hot water than microwaves. And if it burns your hands near a microwave, put your hand near a microwave, all of a sudden you would feel something. It turns out all microwaves, you know, that are sold in this country are shielded. They don't start unless the latch door is latched, so the microwaves cannot escape. They've looked at microwaves, and they have much less radiation than a cell phone, a typical cell phone. And as you go away from the microwave, any of the radiation actually decreases. When you're 2 feet away from a microwave, you have 1/100th the amount of leakage. If there's any leakage, then at 2 inches. And there's no leakage. Microwaves do not leak. It is a total urban myth. It has continued for years. You know, you can't be near a microwave because your pacemaker will be hot. Yeah. I remember I had an uncle with a pacemaker, and he said, oh, don't turn on the microwave. I'm in the kitchen and my pacemaker will get hot. Well, it doesn't get hot because they're shielded. They're safe. You can use them for what you want to. And let's put this myth to bed.
Even if it's a 20-year-old microwave.
They all latched. They all were under federal guidelines. They were never sold as bad microwaves. There were not bad microwaves sold in this country. There's no such thing as a bad microwave.
Well, you don't have to stand close to us to get your myth busted. You just have to send them to us in an email to
Zorba at WPR.org.
Let's get back to the phones now, Zorba. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And an Oklahoma City, Oklahoma listener with us now. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Well, ever since I was probably about 12 years old, I've been battling with trying to gain weight. And I've fluctuated. Whenever I was in high school, I was about 4'11" and I weighed 95 pounds. And now I'm 6'2" and I weigh 120 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'm still below my target, what I would like to weigh. And I eat a lot. It just, I mean, everybody's just kept telling, oh, you have fast metabolism. I think there's something else in there somewhere. So I don't know what's going on, but I would like to gain some weight here.
Yeah, I empathize with you. I'm 6 feet tall and weigh about 147, and I'm very skinny. You are really skinny.
Exactly.
You know,
I can play in my ribs like a xylophone, let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, because there's so much obesity around, you know, we kind of forget the fact that about 5% of the population at 10% wants to gain weight, and it's an issue. And the metabolism on both ends are an issue. You know, there are people who say to me, you know, I can look at food and I gain weight, and I think it's really true. They're extremely efficient with their calories. And then people at the other end of the scale are not efficient at all. And so what happens is they eat and eat and eat, and they don't gain weight at all. They lose weight. And you're obviously an active guy. Do you exercise?
Not really. I mean, I try to be as lethargic as possible.
my kind of guy, in all ways.
I try to be as lethargic as possible. You know, I've got to remember that when I'm talking to my patients. I think I'm trying to be as lethargic. But, you know, some people, you know, do a tremendous amount of exercise. They need a lot of calories, like Michael Phelps. You know, he eats this enormous amount of calories, never gains weight. And, you know, once he stops exercising, if he doesn't change his eating habits, will balloon up like a balloon. But the way to gain weight ultimately is to eat more calories and get a calorie counter, just like people want to lose weight. What you need is you need about 3,000 calories a day to gain weight. So you have to figure out a way to do it. The way that most people gain weight is through high fructose corn syrup and high fat food. That's what they do.
Which isn't healthy at all.
Well, he wants to gain weight. So if you want to gain weight, the way to do it would be to pick something like a milkshake. You know, it's not high fructose, but it's high fat and it's sweet. Mm-hmm. And look at calorie-dense foods that contain oil, you know, and look and eat fried foods. I mean, those are things that you can do. But one way that you could probably do it in a healthier way is to look at protein and increase it with protein shakes. And that's what I would recommend. Look at high protein shakes that are soy shakes.
Well, I did do a protein shake whenever I was in high school. My stepmother at the time was not very happy with the fact that I was still skinny. Mm-hmm. So we bought a huge jug of like 1,615 calories a shake, protein shakes.
And that's what I would go for. There are a variety of protein shakes.
The problem with that, though, is that I was supposed to drink 3 a day. And I drank it for an entire week because it was so expensive. She didn't want to spend money on it if it didn't work. And at the end of the week, I weighed myself, and I only gained a pound.
Right. I'm going to talk a bit about that. If you gained a pound a week for 20 weeks, then you would be gaining 20 pounds. And that's part of your goal. Getting back to the protein shake, what I would do is I would go get some of the generic ones. I mean, you can spend a lot of money on protein shakes. And I would supplement them with ice cream. In other words, I would take a protein shake, I would put in ice cream because that will supplement them with fat, and I do believe you need fat to get fat. And then if you gain a pound a week, hey, It's 20 pounds in 20 weeks. There's nothing wrong with that. I wouldn't eat that as the only food, though. I would use it as a supplement. The other thing you can do is go and get Ensure. Ensure is a protein supplement. We give it to older people, older Americans, when we want to supplement their caloric intake. Ensure is fine. There are generic Ensures there, which are relatively cheap, and that will be more balanced for you. That's another way to gain weight, too. But if you gain a pound or 2 pounds a week, hey, in a half a year to a year, you'd be there, and that's your goal. So I can see that you've got an emotional connection of a negative sort to the protein shakes you had in high school. But you're not in high school anymore, and your stepmother isn't around your house, I'm sure.
Exactly.
And good luck.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Sure, thanks. You think that's better than fast food every day, Zorba?
Yeah, I think it's – well, I mean, he could go do the Super Size Me diet, which is where you're on McDonald's and fast food. And you know what that guy gained? He gained 22 pounds in a month, but did he bloat up.
Well, before we get out of here, Zorba, we have another case for Judge Zorba. This is the cold cookies case from last winter and features a Wisconsin listener named Jenny as the defendant. Here's her testimony. My grandson and I spent a couple of hours making cookies. We set them out on our porch to cool and forgot about them. When my husband took our dog outside for her nighttime walk, he also forgot about the cookies sitting on their cookie sheets and let the cat out on the porch. When we realized where the kitty was 30 minutes later, we were aghast to find her on one of the cookie sheets. I'm thinking, I need to throw these cookies away. My husband thinks they couldn't be that bad because it was about 15 degrees outside. And what could survive that cold? Can you settle the debate for us?
Well, I first of all, settle the debate. I think it's kind of disgusting to eat the cookies that are covered by a cat.
I throw those cookies away. I don't care.
I mean, come on. I mean, I'm as frugal as the next person, but I would take those cookies, and I'm sorry, I would toss them. You know, now, you know, he wants some fur-lined cookies. Well, that's his problem. Cats have toxoplasmosis, so if you're a pregnant woman, you can't have those cookies, period.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you're not, I mean, there are screens that you do to make sure you have antibodies to toxo, but that's about it. But, I side with you. You know, first of all, you know, I can't imagine eating cookies that have been furized by my cat. So I'm with you on this one. Cookies out. Woman one, husband zero.
If you have a case you want Judge Zorba to rule on, send your deposition or email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week.
Take care, Tom, and stay well.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, our producer is available anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Friedrich and Brad Kohlberg are sitting right there on the other side of the glass, kind of like Norm and Cliff from Cheers. Charles Monroe Kane is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0306Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.